Well, I have a wonderful electronic invention I want you to see. It looks something like this.
Hey, what's up, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs looking to grow, not only by learning new things, but by connecting their work to big ideas and overcoming the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. In today's interview episode of Getting Work to Work, I have a chat with Sam Conniff Iende, author of Be More Pirate, or How to Take on the World and Win, about what we can learn from the golden age of pirates, from the true democratic nature of a pirate ship and groundbreaking social contracts, to professional rule breaking and getting into good trouble. Sam shares everything we need to come up with strategies for change at the pace required today. Show notes and links for this episode can be found at gwtw.co/221. Sam, welcome to Getting Work to Work. Why don't you start with introducing yourself and sharing a little bit about what you do?
Thank you very much indeed for having me. As I was just saying before we came on, I've really enjoyed getting to know your series and going back through some of the previous episodes. I managed to not do any work this afternoon because I was quite distracted by the world of getting to work. Yes. My name is Sam Conniff Iende, and I am chiefly at the moment feeling like an imposter. I've spent 20 years of my life as an entrepreneur, a social entrepreneur particularly, trying to find pathways between the intersections of big business and world-changing social innovation, particularly around young people, youth issues, from kind of gang involvement through to refugees, through to getting kids into education.
Wow.
And a year ago, I left my 11th startup that's been running for 18 years. I was chief exec there for over a decade. And I stepped aside to let a new generation come through. I've listened to enough podcasts like yours and others around leadership to know that the idea of founder syndrome is real, and there comes a time when everyone must move on. Mm-hmm. And I've spent a year somewhat of identity crisis, somewhat of soul searching, and I've found myself as a best-selling author at the end of it. And I am as surprised as I think my publishers, my wife, and anyone else.
That's awesome. So one of the things that we're really going to talk about today is your book, Be More Pirate, or How to Take on the World and Win, which was just released in the US this week. And so congratulations on that.
Thank you very, very much indeed. It means an awful lot to me. I'm, you know, like I say, debut author. This whole thing's been such an exercise in learning, right? Like every day I can feel my ears pinned to the side of my head by the accelerated rate of what I'm learning. And originally, I'm with Penguin Random House, which in the UK is our biggest publisher. And they originally passed on the US rights. And I thought that's fine. You know, I wasn't expecting it to go anywhere. So to now be published by Simon & Schuster after it went to bidding an auction, I mean, I am humbled and proud and incredibly honored to be have a chance to bring this message to the States.
That's great. And it's a great message. It's, as I mentioned, one of the most enjoyable, engaging books that I've read in some time. And so the first question that I have is, what were you seeing in your daily life that led you to write a book about pirates?
Well, you know, firstly, that's a big compliment from a man I know reads a fuck a lot of books. So thanks. Excuse me. Sorry, my language. From a guy I can tell reads a lot.
Let it fly.
All right, cool. You know, from just, you know, scanning the episodes and listening to a few, I know you read a lot. Mm-hmm. So thank you. The first to pass was actually a really awful book. It was called Purpose First, and it was the argument for the conscientious revolution within business. And whilst politics, you know, regardless of your political leanings, I'm not going to get into that, but politics in terms of an independent form of leadership that's pushing us in the right direction as fast as we need to go, I think globally is letting us down. And perhaps, you know, business really rising to its next iteration. You know, we certainly see the impact of, you know, the positive and negative impacts of capitalism over the last 100 years or so. What happens next? And what if business takes a more enlightened approach to everything from the environment through technology and the next stage? You know, there are a lot of conversations in business pushing that direction. And it was a kind of a call to arms. But in truth, man, seeing as I know the kind of honesty that you push for in these episodes, it was me trying to be a grown up. I was leaving behind my life of a startup. I started the agency that I'm leaving in 24, my first startup when I was a teenager. And I think I'd always stayed in that mindset. So this was me kind of being a grown-up. And because all my work has been in around youth culture, and certainly the social enterprises have been working with young people, smart young people, young entrepreneurs, incredible young people, often like left behind by society. I think I've kind of stayed a bit too young as well. So I'd promised that when I was 40, I'd step aside, let a new generation come through, take over the business. 40 is too old to run a youth project, right? That was easy for me to say in my early 20s because 40 seemed like it was never going to happen. And then it did, and it wasn't a joke, and it was time to move on. So I think I wrote the book I thought a grown-up was going to write. And I managed to get it commissioned, and I was 20,000 words in. And I got to tell you, it was the most boring book on earth. This conversation wouldn't even be happening, you know, let alone your kind words. The thing I love most about the work that I've done with young people and Liberty over the years is the young entrepreneurs, the innovators, or the entrepreneurs, you know, the guys in business but frustrated and trying to start their thing. I've worked with thousands of them all over the world. And I mentor them regularly and I run workshops regularly. And I was testing out some of the material and the narrative, and they were just looking at me like, what has happened to you? And I was like trying to be my dad, like, yeah, so the next stage of business is... And one guy said to me, who knows me really well, Callum, and he said, what has happened to your usual chat? Where's the inspiration? You know, where's the energy? Where's the what next? Where's the challenge? Where's all the pirates? And it's been a metaphor of mine throughout life, as it has for lots of, you know, they are the lovable rogues and rebels that we all like to point at. And I went back to my desk and I wrote on a piece of paper, where are all the pirates? And I started rewriting from the very beginning, blank page, page one. And started using the metaphor of pirates. I started thinking about the guys that I really, really support. On a bad day, if I'm working in government or near some of the kind of leaders that I think aren't really stepping up to the mark, it's easy to get despondent. You know, how long have we got to wait before there's a new generation in charge? Or not even a generation, not an age, but a mindset. And then there's days when I'm working, it might be I've done incredible work with young guys from Baltimore, Illinois, Detroit, Chicago, or Athens, or Johannesburg, anywhere in the world. You know, it's really smart guys trying to make a difference and believing they can. And I realized that's who the book's for. That's who I want to talk about. That's where the rallying cry is required. And my metaphor fits, right? These are the pirates. These are the rebels. These are the guys at the edges. These are the people we need to break some rules and shake things up a little bit, because the last thing we want them to do is to wait in line for what comes next. We haven't got time for that. The last thing we want them to do is to follow in the practices that were innovative in their time but no longer really fit for purpose. These are the guys we really want to act and behave like pirates. And I started there.
That's absolutely awesome. And what I love about that is, you know, we don't have the time to wait. And so what were some of the things as you dove into the history of pirates that you really started to see parallels to today and the tools and techniques that we need in order to make sense of today's world?
I would love to pretend that I had the foresight to see this coming, right? So it started as a metaphor, and I thought, okay, we'll push on, and I'll make my argument, you know, advocate these young people get more of an opportunity and a chance. And there's, you know, I see that there's a kind of almost an intergenerational opportunity. We've got great organizations and great leaders, and we need longevity and life experience, and you know, nothing can replace the hard fought battle scars. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if we don't let a new drive, a new sense, new, you know, there's a lot of complaints about young generations, Gen Z, millennials, whatever. But if we don't let some new thinking in to challenge some of the existing problems we've got, we're not going to get to answers. Who was it? Einstein says, if you tackle the problem with the same thinking that got you to the problem, you're never going to get to an answer. And so I started doing the research. Now I have a bit of a chip on my shoulder, let's say. Do you have that phrase out there?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so I've got this nagging sense of doubt. I'm dyslexic and I never made it to university, so I'm not academic. I've never really done any major research work. And my big fear is I know there's quite a lot of entrepreneurs that listen to the show. What would happen if I did something on my own? All of my businesses have been big teams. So the Eleanor Roosevelt, the quote that I really live by is, if you want to know what you should do next, you should find the thing that scares you most. So all of that pulled me into this idea of a book. And I went down to the British Library, the Greenwich Maritime Museum, everywhere that I could find, you know, reliable primary sources about the golden age of pirates. And I fell into the research. And it wasn't easy for me at first. But page by page, I started to discover something. And what had begun as a metaphor really became a lot deeper. and, you know, just to reel some of the things that I discovered off that surprised me, that might surprise you guys listening. So the average age of the pirates is 27. So they were the millennials of the 18th century. Exactly 300 years ago, 1718, 1719 was the midst of the golden age. These guys were professionals. For 100 years, piracy had been legitimate and endorsed by the state. In fact, it had been advocated and you had to pay a cutback. But through diplomacy, suddenly a legitimate way of doing business and generating income was now declared illegal. So the morality issue is really, you know, null and void. And then because these guys were operating outside the rules of a really bust society, and by bust, I mean there's a really self-interested establishment that doesn't seem to have a long-term plan for this generation. Sound familiar? And there's this backdrop of international interconnected conflict where nobody really knows who's the baddie and the goodie anymore. Sound familiar? And there's a new wave of industry and technology which is fueling mass redundancy. You know, sounds dangerously familiar, the whole thing, but... And herein lies the lesson. This is why these guys have need to return as valid role models for the hour we're in. Rather than complain, rather than, you know, lose themselves on Instagram, rather than just sit by, they rewrote the rules of their society. They wrote a new social contract and they stepped outside bust rules. They didn't fight for them. They didn't cause chaos. They stepped outside the rules and wrote new ones. So on board a pirate ship in pirate societies, there was a level of fairness. So there was fair pay that they had never experienced. Fair pay, higher and lower thresholds, index links, one of the biggest recommendations that came out of all the 2008-2009 financial crisis. So there shouldn't be highly accelerated differences between the lowest and the highest paid. There was gender equality. You know, there was no gender pay gap. There was no ethnicity pay gap. There was a very high rate of diversity. About 33% of pirate crews were non-white. People of color were captains. There was equal opportunity for leadership. The pirates were regularly releasing, freeing slaves 150 years before the abolition of slavery and introducing them into their crews within societies with equal say. There was a system of workplace compensation. If you lost a leg, Chris, you'd get 800 pieces of eight as your compensation. Compensation that wasn't even a law by that point, 140 years before it became law and eventually it becomes a human right. There was universal suffrage before that fight had even began. Everybody had say. There was a holocratic form of organization. There was facilitative leadership. You know, some of the most interesting ideas and buzzwords even that we talk about in business, how to organize ourselves better, find a sense of self-determination and discipline, was seen on board a pirate ship. And this is only a 30-year period, right? The golden age of piracy lasts 1619 to roughly 1720. And these guys were up against the world, literally up against the world. They were such criminals that they were no longer regarded as enemies of the state. They were regarded as enemies of humanity. And when they heard that, their response was not just, you know, fuck you in pirate terms. They declared a war against the world. So free of the shackles of a bust flush system, they rewrote a level of fairness that no one in the world had seen until that point. No one. And many of their innovations, people think the democratic ideas, you know, born in Athens, pirate ships were more democratic than Athenian democracy, where only the white men had the vote. On board a pirate ship, everybody had equal say, and they were so accountable. And we've got a big lesson to learn from this. Their leaders were truly accountable to their community because at any given moment, the community could depose the leader. There weren't election cycles as we have, and so therefore they couldn't be corrupted in the same way. These guys, it's like, you know, the dawn of Silicon Valley, or maybe the Second World War, or the turn of the 19th century, when there's these intense periods of humanity and innovation under pressure. And I think it's like that. I genuinely, honestly would argue they probably belong, rather than where we currently hold them, which is, you know, somewhere between a Hollywood film franchise and an acceptable theme for a seven-year-old's birthday party, which is weird enough in itself, let's be honest, right? What other rebels and rogues and murderous villains from history do you know, even if they've got kind of some quasi-lefty socialist leanings? I mean, have you ever let your kids go to a Pablo Escobar birthday party? No. Yet somehow we've got this relationship with pirates which lets us, we let them in. It's because deep down we know there was something going on. We know there was something going on. And it's the true part of the history. And this is it page after page. I couldn't believe, why isn't this the history we know? Why isn't, you know, these are amazing innovations. And I firmly believe that based on their way they were viewed at the time, which is of working class heroes and social revolutionaries, that truly they exist on some kind of spectrum. This is a big claim to make, but some kind of spectrum alongside the suffragettes and the civil rights movement. Like truly, they put their necks on the line. They fought and died for fairness, justice, and equality. And of course, rum and stolen Spanish gold. But we know that part of the story, and I'm happy to talk about the morality of it. But the part we don't know feels incredibly valuable and valid for our times.
Yes. Well, and it's interesting too, because as you're describing, you know, the amazing things that the pirates did that we don't really know about, you really paint this tale of how the established order villainized the pirates of history and almost see the parallels in today's world.
Yeah, totally. And that's why there's this, you know, I was asking myself the question throughout the writing of the book. Well, I was asking two questions, right? The first one was, you know, how can this be the case, but none of us have learned this in our history lessons? What on earth is going on? And the second one was, surely somebody else has spotted this and someone's writing the same book as me, or have they written it? And so I was relentlessly Googling, you know, surely this book exists. And the closest I found is a really good book by Adam Morgan, who I think you've also interviewed, who wrote The Pirate Inside, which is an excellent book. And at the end of chapter one, where he draws some of the analogies I'm talking about, he concludes chapter one by saying, these lessons of pirates have got a great deal to teach us, but only an idiot would try and extend this metaphor to an entire book. And then he goes into some more robust 21st century frameworks. So I took great confidence there that I must be that idiot. But luckily, no one entirely had. But the journey, as I looked out each and every day, was made really clear to me because, you know, as I explained, I've spent 20 odd years running my own organizations, particularly themed around marketing and social change for young people. And I was very aware of the cliche that I could have be about to become, right? 40-year-old, middle-class, middle-aged white guy becomes author and public speaker and tells the world what he thinks. I know you know what I mean, right?
Absolutely.
And obviously I've totally failed and fallen into my own cliche, but there's at least the self-awareness to try and stop me becoming an exercise in pontification. That's what I was really concerned with. And so I, after that first workshop where these guys, you know, kicked me in the ass, basically, I relentlessly workshopped the material. And so there's an interesting reverse diaspora of entrepreneurs I've worked with in Athens who've gone back there since the financial collapse to try and prop up the Greek economy, which, as you know, has really struggled. I came over your sides and worked in Baltimore running sessions with young social entrepreneurs from Illinois, Detroit, Chicago, you know, cities facing incredibly tough times, lack of infrastructural strategy, and yet they're still starting initiatives on the street that generate income and create change, you know, so the pioneering hard edge of it in the townships of South Africa, from Mamelodi to Johannesburg, in tough areas in the UK, from Brixton to Bradford. You know, I deliberately went to try and find the audience that would most call bullshit on me. And the audience I think that we most need, all of us collectively, and that sometimes, to be honest, we most overlook. You know, even you and I, it's very hard to find those guys on, you know, our favorite podcasts or in the kind of examples we look at. It's, you know, we regularly trot out the same, you know, over deference towards Stanford, Silicon Valley, etc. Of course, where there's tons of learnings, I'm not denying that, but I think we fail to sometimes draw the opportunity for education and innovation from the edges, from the shadows. And so I wanted to prove this thing worked there. And about midway through the workshopping of it, and I'd really, you know, been forced to question a lot of my ideas and a lot of my case studies, and, you know, this analogy of pirates was really, 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 like, firmly working. You know, people were getting up off their chairs, and this was good. The number one feedback I got, the killer feedback, was in South Africa, and these young guys, where I was really worried the pirate analogy would be adrift. I thought, at least in the States, you know, you guys probably are even more behind pirates than anyone else. And these guys said to me, you know what, Sam, pirates, they fuck shit up. And I'm what do you mean? And it turns out, in young South African slang, fuck shit up means to go out and positively create change. You know, we're going to fuck shit up. Like, actually go, you know, to hustle, to shake things up. And I loved that, you know, that they've just taken ownership of that phrase, completely messed around with the negativity to the positivity. And I was like, just, you know, that is an ethos I can get behind, a philosophy. And if, you know, it's not as credible or compelling, me, this, you know, old white dude saying this, but, you know, when I'm being told, when I've managed to connect with this young South African township guy, then I knew that there was some strength in this material. And I don't want to get drawn into the political dispute, but I wrote the book throughout 2016 and 17, so we all know what's going on in the world. And outside of the kind of rights and wrongs and who do you back and who don't you back, the truth is there is a lack of big consensus ideas that are pushing us forward in the way that there have been when there's previous big advances in humanity. And we run the risk of infighting when we need to be fighting together. You know, it seems to me that we are amidst the World War II of our generation and, you know, with the erosion of democracy and the destruction of the environment at risk, we're all either, you know, everyone anywhere in any business or organization has to decide which side you're on. And so to know that I've got a message that's resonating at that level, that began to feel like a, you know, not just an honor, but like a responsibility. There's something good here. So I kept that principle throughout. I workshopped it to the last, and those kind of guys I've continued to deliver back for when I've been asked to go and do talks or take workshops together. I will serve those communities as strongly as I can, whilst also trying to make the book a commercial success, because that's where it's born from, and I think that's where the change we need is going to come from.
Yes. Well, as you're talking and describing these communities that you've been entering into and serving with this message, is you talk in the book about the concept of getting into good trouble.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Aha. Well, you know, this comes from your neck of the woods, to be honest. Congressman John Lewis, who led the march across the bridge at Selma, led the civil rights movement throughout the 60s, continues to lead a fight for justice today, led one of the first ever sit-ins in Congress after, I think it was not the Parkland shooting, I think the Florida shooting. And, you know, he gave a commencement address where he, to me, captured the paradox of our times perfectly. And he says to these young guys, you need to stand up and speak up and speak out. And you need to find a way to get in the way. You need to find a way to cause trouble, but good trouble, necessary trouble. And to me, that just struck a chord, because the message that the if anybody listening hasn't got time, right, because you're, you know, like the rest of us, there isn't much time and you're wondering what this is all about, I can help you avoid the need for, you know, reading 60,000 words. The line in the book really that sums it all up is, the biggest mistake we can make is that the way things are is not the way things have to be. Like, that's it. And that sounds simple, but it's really hard. It's really hard to make the kind of shift that we need. It's a simple mindset shift, but that's it. And I think too often we find ourselves in business, in organizations, you know, why are we doing it like this? I don't know. That's the way it's been. This is a daft and stupid rule. Why do we do it like that? Well, that's the way it's been done. You know, how many times have you heard that? And the more I've studied this idea of rules, because, you know, I get questioned a lot, often by my wife, you know, do I really mean this rule breaking? Like, is this really positive? Where does this go wrong? I'm not talking about regulations. I'm not talking about the laws that are there to protect us. I'm talking about the rules that we allow to govern us, the habits, the conventions, the status quo. And 9 times out of 10, when there's something really stupid in your organization, try and follow that back, you know, like you do, you know, in a good crime movie, follow the money, follow that rule back and see if anyone actually owns it, or whether it's just a bad habit that's formed over time. And if this book was about breaking bad habits, you know, I wouldn't get the criticism, but it needs a stronger narrative than that. And so I've landed on this notion of professional rule breaking. And that's really the articulation of good trouble in the workplace, professional rule breaking. Mm-hmm. And I measure success for this by, on average, you know, nearly getting fired once a year. That means you're probably pushing it, you know, far enough, but, you know, it's an art. This is an art to rule breaking. You're not getting fired, but you are advocating change. You are challenging. You're not just sitting back and letting it wash over you, you know, and that's really the challenge. You know, we're all participant in this great big mess that we're in. Therefore, we're all participant in the solutions. And if we're not pushing at the edges, what are we doing? Mm.
That's very powerful.
Well, it got me in some trouble. My wife recently, her new tagline is "Be less pirate," because the journey we've been on has been something. And the big surprise has been not the commercial success, which is a very welcome surprise, of course. It's been the rebellion. It's been the mutiny that's formed up around the book. This community of people started a couple of weeks in. I got my first email from someone who wrote to me forwarding me their resignation letter, and they quoted me the line in the book. They said, I got to this line and I thought, fuck it, you know what, you're right. It's time to cause some real change in the world. Just to let you know, here's my resignation. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. I didn't mean it. And of course I did. And the next day there was another, and the next day there's another, and then two, and then three, and the next day there was five. And it's just grown and grown and grown. And now I'm into the 100. I can't even I can't keep up. I'm just in the process of recruiting in the UK a full-time community manager because this thing has just escalated. We've organized the first pirate meetups that are starting to take place from January. The first one sold out in an hour. I mean, it's free, but it sold out. So there's this real, like, there's a mood for this. There's a real a sense that this is in the air and this is very important. And, you know, I mean, how familiar are we all in our places of work or education or wherever we go that we need to, you know, how many times we say the words transformation and disruption and, you know, we need to be more agile about this. And how many times we walk out of those sessions knowing that there is no single way whatsoever that we're about to move as fast as the speed of disruption that's taking place outside the door. You know, it's just fundamentally not happening. And permission-based change won't get us there because we all know how permission-based change works, right? I've got a really good idea. Brilliant. Send it to me on an email and we'll kill it in an email thread asking each other's ideas. And that's, you know, that's just what we've grown up with. So non-permission-based change or a mutiny where you take into accountability your own actions and you begin to do something in a different and new way, allowing yourself to create a precedent of which the only success metric is somebody else follows your precedent, is exactly the same technique how we get into bad habits in the first place. So reverse it and create good habits and new rules within organizations. And I've been, I was talking about this at the launch of the book, and I got called into really one of the businesses that I would most ever dream of being called into at Lego. Oh, wow. A workshop based on professional rule breaking and creating mutiny and not asking for permission and starting new processes without having to go through HR. And it was like, I mean, you know, it went quiet. And it's been considered one of the most radical but successful frameworks for change. And now I've been booked in from Heineken to Mercedes. I mean, you know, really conservative, large global organizations, because at least they're coming to terms with the fact that we haven't got a strategy for change at the pace that's required. So I am, like I said at the beginning, as surprised as anybody, more so probably. About the rebellions, about, you know, the synergy, about the validity of this message. But by God, man, I'm now, you know, dedicating myself to this for the foreseeable future because it feels like there is truly something here.
So as you're describing this movement, how do we ignore the rules, you know, what you call what should be, so that we can experiment with the way things could be?
That's a good question. I think the first step is just to pick a rule and try breaking it. What rule do you follow, Chris, that you don't really agree with? Just to like put this on the spot, what thing is there in your day or week, you know, that you know you don't think is necessary, yet you still will do it?
There is a feeling about education that, mm-hmm. you know, that you have to go through the appropriate organizations and structures in order to have a valid education. But I don't know if I necessarily agree with that anymore, given the pace of online education and tools available now. So it's a daily struggle because I teach at the college level, but at the same time, I argue internally about whether it's valid anymore.
Excellent. What a great example. So that's totally drawing on, you know, real life experience. We can trust you. You're a college teacher. You've got a breadth of experience. You're also a public figure. So, you know, that's considered. Okay, so that's a stupid. I would completely agree with you. I mean, how on earth do we think that the kind of curriculum that's passed down through the framework of decision making can keep pace with the needs of the future workforce or even just, you know, the needs of human talent? So what's the new rule? Let's stop that. So, you know, maybe day to day, most you have to continue delivering on your work. But what is the new rule? How could you, what's the new framework to allow young people or students of yours to learn at their own self-taught pace using the digital opportunities that are available for them?
Right. Well, it becomes less about the curriculum you're devising in a particular class and shifting the mindset to, okay, how are you going to not only think about this subject in a way that impacts your life, but sets you on a path so that you don't need this class to continue learning.
Ha! Now we're talking. So you give the guys in the class the goal, the result that you want, and you ask them to design their curriculum.
Yep.
So this is where I want you to be in 3 months. How would you teach yourself that? and then you see what they give you.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so no one gets in trouble because, you know, this is about good trouble and this is about professional rule breaking. You then teach the curriculum they hand you. Mm-hmm. So I believe in this so much. And I was looking at some of the data in the UK about YouTube searches. And that young people get a pretty bad press in the UK, that they are, you know, a negative force and they are problematic and so on and so forth. From the YouTube data that I could get, you know, we know that YouTube's number one search engine in the world for that age range. And we know how to is the biggest prefix. And if you then remove from the searches how to kiss and like all the important stuff, the what's left is really interesting. The top five is how to foreign language. Is visual communication, like photography, drawing, design, etc. Is engineering, basically taking shit apart and putting it back together. And number one was coding. Hmm. Now, visual communication, foreign language, engineering, and I mean, that is a pretty enlightened curriculum. Compare that with the public school system and what we're teaching young people. Which one would I back? So, dude, the next part of this stage, so you've seen the rule you want to break. You've got a new rule. I'm verifying it from my own data over here. So now, tomorrow is mutiny day, day one. You just start making it happen. What's going to happen? What's the worst that can happen? How much trouble are they going to get in or are you going to get in if you allow them to start designating the curriculum from the most powerful source of learning on earth and not necessarily the book that you've been given? What's the worst that can happen? Who's going to get in trouble? Versus what's the best that can happen? Versus what's the absolute best that can happen? Suddenly you've got students who might take a further degree of responsibility or accountability for their learning. You might tap into things that you've never learned before. You might have new opportunities for learning that you can share with other teachers. No one's going to lose their job. No one's going to lose their college place. You're giving it a bit of a test. And now who's accountable for making this shit work? You can't blame the college. You can't complain about, well, you know, actually the curriculum we're given isn't really good enough because you just let the students write the curriculum.
Yep.
So who's responsible for getting there in 3 months to their goals? Nobody but them. And who's accountable for making sure they do the best? Then you. Mm-hmm. This is the thing that surprised me most about pirates. And really, you know, yes, there's the romantic side of it. And you know, this is a fun new way of looking at things. But the underlying reason why this is important for our times and the message they've truly given us is once you've stepped outside the rules that otherwise we've been bitching about and you've written your own, it's really a story of accountability. Mm-hmm. There's no one else. And at the moment, I think this is necessary because, frankly, no one else is coming to save us. You know, there is no grand master plan to get us out of the mess we're in. It does come down to us. Yet we are, you know, incredible human beings. All of us have stood up to the world at one part and won, but that's rarely the person that we bring to work. You know, look what you've made as Chris Martin. You've made this incredible platform inspiring God knows, but probably millions of people you've reached. And yet at work, and this is what meant with total respect, you would, you know, have this big internal narrative. You know, can I change something? Can I make a difference here? Can I take this into my own hands? And of course, I mean, you're like Batman. At night, you've got this, you know, incredible superpower. And then by day, you know, Clark Kent's wondering whether he could do this thing. And like, why don't we bring that self to work? The self that has stood up against the world and changed it. We disempower ourselves. And so this notion of rule breaking, picking a rule, anybody listening can do the exact same exercise. What's the thing I disagree with? And then what happens if you stop disagreeing, complaining, or whinging about it and say, okay, what's my new rule? And then once you've got an idea, because I know you've all got an idea, what happens if I start doing that tomorrow? A, nothing bad. B, probably something good. And C, who's now accountable for making this work? You. And that's what meant that for 30-odd years, pirates were unbeatable. You know, the Royal British Navy, the Spanish Armada, the East India Company, the biggest powers on the sea, right? They were sometimes outnumbered 45 to 1. But on their side, they had the moment. They had the idea of the times. They had the heart of the people. You know, this was the future. This is where we want to go. And that was really, which comes back to your earlier question, why they had to be crushed. You know, the threat was too great. This is pre-democracy. This is an America run by colonial governors, controlled by a king across the water. This is, you know, Europe hoping that France doesn't rebel and have its revolution and turn Europe into an entire system of revolution. This is England, you know, still scarred from a civil war. And so this successful example of proto-democracy was unacceptable to the established order. And that's what really was in one sense so terrifying for everyone, and the other sense was so intoxicating for you guys, because you know, the colonial governors were not disinterested, let's say, in the petri dish that was taking place down in the Caribbean, because when the pirates' success became so great and they were joined by like-minded rebels from the world over, they took these organizing principles off boats and onto land. And in Nassau, this democracy, you know, proto-democracy, let's call it, formed. And for nearly a decade, you know, to all extents and purposes, it was self-evident that all people were regarded equal. And a certain level of inspiration began to take place, I would say, informing ideas of what broader scale democracy could look like. And there are some, you know, great pirate observers and historians that will argue strongly that this exercise in democracy was one that was followed swiftly by the greatest democracy on earth.
So as you're describing the proto-democracy of the American colonies, the musical Hamilton is popping up into my head, and how Alexander Hamilton was from the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And I wonder if he was influenced by the pirates of the day.
Well, I pushed hard on that piece of research, and there's a really great podcast by a guy called Matt Albers called the Pirate History Podcast, and he's certainly seen it as well. It's one of the deepest investigations into pirate history that covers all parts of their story, and he concludes in exactly the same place. And really, he helped me switch on to this notion, because you know, the colonial governors, what did they want? They wanted to harry the British. They wanted to interfere with taxes. They wanted to get ready for their own tea party that was looming. There's lots of evidence that they were employing pirates as their militia to inform that work. There was money being made. I mean, Blackbeard was at you know, various colonial governors' weddings. I mean, there's a lot of overlap. I think a whole bunch of documents were actually found on his ship that he'd been working in as an extension of the governor. So there was a real close line in that. And the message was felt around the world. Back in the UK, one of the things that I discovered that I really enjoyed was after the end of the Golden Age, around the 1730s, a lot of the pirates' origin is from Wales, which is a tiny country in the United Kingdom, but very famous for its kind of hardy nature. And the, you know, at that time, you get back to Britain, and we're talking about the dawn of industrialization. We're talking about the dark satanic mills of William Blake's poetry, and a very brutal system, you know, with no workers' rights whatsoever. In fact, workers' rights were illegal, and you could be hauled away if you'd been having that kind of narrative. And what forms in the very next town from Captain Morgan's hometown, Robert Owens is born, and he's the godfather, the grandfather of the cooperative movement. And as I pushed on this, it's like, well, here's another synergy that feels very familiar. So a new kind of quasi-democratic organizational system that stands up against the bus status quo that allows individuals to organize themselves. So I went to the Cooperative Museum in Manchester in the north of England, and I discovered the 7 founding principles of the cooperative movement. And then I looked back to the Pirate Code, and 6 of the founding principles of the cooperative movement, the co-ops, you know, the which touch a billion people every single day, like 10% of all businesses are cooperative. 6 of their founding principles are found directly in the surviving copies of the Pirate Code. So from the foundations of American democracy to the story of Hamilton to the ideas of progressive shared-owned business to, you know, workplace compensation, that's what I mean, man. This period of innovation is overlooked at our peril at a moment when we suffer from a vacuum of imagination of a leadership level. And what we are looking towards is a generation who hopefully will leapfrog the traditional hierarchy to power. And in there lies the message of pirates and their relevance for the day that we are in.
That's so awesome. One of the quotes that really struck me as I was reading the book was from Margaret Wheatley.
Yes.
And that said, all social change begins with a conversation.
Yeah.
So in the age of shouting our opinions, are we losing the art of conversation?
Good question. I don't know the answer to that one. I've not been asked it. I think it's a really interesting question. I think there's something paradoxical going on. I I would say that there's something dangerous in terms of our conversation's quality online in certain social media forms. You know, it can be used as a hotbed for debate, but I also think it can be polarizing and not allow depth of conversation. So that's something to watch out for. But I think in the rise of, you know, what you are, the podcast, you know, the meteoric rise of what is a media format that I think helps us push back against headline grabbing clickbait that's dominated, you know, a lot of media for the last decade. You know, you guys are making hour long conversations of depth that feel really important and relevant. And to be honest, you know, I've had this, the book has been 6 months a bestseller in the United Kingdom. Nearly every single press, traditional press interview I've done has been clipped short to the second. You know, you have to use your media training, get across your three key messages, and that kind of like that kind of shit really that doesn't help us have a deeper conversation. And here we are, you know, I've come on this with no agenda. You've got really great questions. We're going at a level of depth. We're philosophical, historical, you know. So hopefully in there, and that richness is why your audience love and respect and listen to this show. Hi guys. And so I think there's a duality to it. I think we are finding new ways of having deeper conversations. And I think some of the ways that have cheapened conversation are, you know, luckily at risk. And I think we are aware of that. But the point of the quote, I think, is it's so easy to mistake that power. And when I first found Margaret Wheatley, I worried, you know, that that's like a really glib Instagram quote. And actually, you know, real power requires real meaning. And here am I, you know, 20 years in, a social entrepreneur. I've built international businesses. I've worked with some of the biggest businesses on earth, trying to bring their power to help young people, from PlayStation to Unilever to Facebook and Google. So I believed in that sense. We need scale. We need backing. We need resources. And here I am, 6 months into becoming an author and feeling like an imposter, as I said. And I'm suspect that the most powerful thing I've ever done to create any kind of change in the world is a funny little paperback book. Because the messages I'm getting, you know, these knock knock knocks on my inbox door every day, are not of "Can you tell me what to do?" or "Can we join your organization?" It's "This is what I've done. Like the book, thanks very much, and I've done this." And that's where I think Wheatley is correct, and historically she's dug right into it. All great change in the world begins with a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens. And just at this moment, if you're out there looking out on this big old mess, or you're trying to get your shit off the ground and you feel like you're up against all the odds of it and it's just too much, take great courage, because everything begins with a small group. Everything meaningful, everything positive, everything good begins with a small group. And we synthesize that a lot. You know, all the big businesses in the world are terrified of who's going to disrupt them. So what do? They make labs to put together small groups of people, or they go and buy the small guys. Don't mistake the power that we've got to create major change. And don't mistake, actually, the fallibility of the big guys. Big in big business is no longer an asset, but a liability. There's this great essay I refer to in the book, The Paradox of Scale, where the balance of power is really shifting. And I think no one would really want you to think that have power. But again, this is the story of the pirates. They were a tiny community up against the world's greatest powers. And they weren't deliberately, you know, beautiful progressives who tried to, you know, create fair systems for us to inherit 300 years later. They were trying to make a better system for themselves, and a small group that fought for what they believed was right and fair, and they had values that they were willing to fight and die for. That is what's required to make the kind of difference that we need.
Yeah. Because as you mentioned, what you stand for will count more than ever, and who you stand up to will come to define you.
Is that my quote? Is that from the book?
That is.
That's really good. I might post that. Thanks.
You're welcome. It's just interesting because as you think about pirates, as you think about, you know, larger than life companies, we are seeing the fallibility in more ways than one in large companies. I mean, just looking at, you know, the drama of Facebook right now and what they've done with our data, you know, it's, on one hand, you know, you see both sides of the argument. You see the people like, well, Google did it before, so we shouldn't care, to, man, I'm out of here.
Yeah. Well, totally. I think it's right. I think there's an interesting question here, isn't there? So pirates are criminals. But where do we stand on this when criminality and legality begins to become quite blurred? Because, yeah, sure, we've got Facebook over there, but we never fully held to account ExxonMobil for BP for Valdez, or ExxonMobil for the Gulf disaster, or when have we really, who went to prison for the 2008-2009 financial crisis? So when we know that big business has played a role in what, if anybody else had done it, would be deemed a criminal act, how robust is our methodology of criminality and how we pressure it from a legality point of view? So actually, this is a question of morality. And that's why I think it goes back to values. The pirates were effective because they had values they would live and die for. Mm. Chris, what value do you hold so dear that you would be willing to fight for it and risk that which you've built?
Wow, that's a deep question. I mean,
it's a fucking tough question, isn't it? And
yeah,
in a way it shouldn't be. It's like, we should all know this, but that's what I think this pushes at, because what's around us, I think that there's a lot to look up to with Facebook and the business they've created. I think lots of us do and did, and it's technology and it's opportunity is huge. And so when you feel let down, so disappointedly let down by organizations that promised to be good, this point about values, I think, becomes ever more important, and it's of decreasing importance. And I ask that in the book, can you name three values that you'd be willing to fight for? And when I say fight, I mean fight, like throw a punch or take a punch and actually fight, risk what you love. And it's a very hard question for people to ask. And should it be, we currently stand, do we need to remind ourselves of what's worth fighting for?
Is there a pattern that you witness globally in terms of the inability to answer that question, or is it localized in different ways?
No, I've not seen any major global difference to it. I mean, the book's been out in the UK. It's out in the US this week, and then Russia and various European countries, Canada, Australia, all to follow. So I've yet to see. I've only done one talk in the States, and you're the third interview I've done of anyone over there. So I'm very interested to see how it goes down. The one talk was brief, and I was inundated after that. It's people referring, saying it's life-changing. So I'm so – if I've had this response over here, what's it going to be like over there? I cannot wait to see. I think the difference, if I think it through, and again, I never mean to tee up a kind of intergenerational conflict. So I don't think it's down to that. But I think it's often been more difficult for the more experienced or older guys in workshops that I've run to be able to really name that point about values. And I think maybe there's something in that. There's something about the level of compromise we go through to get stuff done eventually. That maybe diminishes the clarity around that. And often the younger guys, the young social entrepreneurs, there's no fucking question or hesitation. They know clearly what they stand for. And I think that's the point of that quote. I think for a while we've needed to be ready to stand up for what we believe in. But if we agree that this is the fight of our times, then actually it's who you're willing to stand up to. This idea of, maybe we're in a moment when we do need to choose sides and not to turn it into a conflict, because there's enough of that, certainly in your country and in this country, but we need to choose sides on what really matters. And when I say we, of course, dear listeners out there, I mean you.
Yes. So this has been a fantastic conversation. I've loved absolutely every moment of it. Thank you. I just have a couple quick questions for you.
Yes, sure.
What would be on your soundtrack for being more pirate?
Excellent question. I have made a Spotify playlist for my Be More Pirate when I was writing the book to keep me in the mood. Nice. And it's got all my rebel sounds. So it's got Public Enemy, it's got Foo Fighters, it's got Placebo, it's got The Clash. It's got quite a lot of grime, UK kind of garage music on there. It's got some quite angry drum and bass, basically anything Dave Grohl. Yeah, and this morning has been Foo Fighters, nice. Completely on the highest volume, keeping myself fighting right to the line before Christmas.
Yeah, their concert at Wembley Stadium that they released a few years ago was phenomenal.
I just think they it's partly just that they've never not looked like they're enjoying themselves. I love them, I really do, and it's that and maybe it's true to say The Clash or something is more of a true pirate spirit, but. It's whatever's going to help you in that moment. Like you asked me earlier, what's the first step in this? So what is it that today is going to help you break a rule? Because I think a bit like making sure you get your 7 hours sleep or your 5-a-day veg or whatever it is. Break a little rule every day. Make it a daily habit. And then when the time comes that you really, really need to break something, when seriously it's the right thing to do the wrong thing, your rule-breaking muscle will be exercised and ready. And if it's a bit of Foo Fighters that helps you get there, then that's what it's for.
Nice. Well, final question for you, Sam. Apart from your own book, what book or resource should all creative professionals read?
Good question. I'll break the rules and go with two. So I think the most important book I've read of the moment is a book called New Power. It's often brought alongside Be My Pirate, and it really discusses in this digital age, in a kind of post-democracy, all the different kind of words that are bandied around. It's a really clear articulation about how every individual has got a sense of power. I found it deeply motivating, a fantastic book. But if the question precisely was about creatives, then I would champion Ryan Holiday's probably least well-known book called Perennial Seller, where he really dissects what it means not to create something for a moment of launch, but to create something for a lifetime of creative success. And I've read that cover to cover 3 times in the process of writing this book. I think Ryan Holiday is pretty amazing anyway, but I think that's one of his most underrated but most accurate and powerful books for any creative out there.
Excellent. Well, Sam, it's been an absolute pleasure to spend this time with you. I've enjoyed reading your book. I've enjoyed hearing your stories. And may you continue calling out the bullshit of heated toilet seats.
I'm glad you read that piece. Excellent. Chris, the same goes for me, man. As of the first link I got sent to your site and the time that I've spent lost in your episodes, I've become a real fan of yours. So it's an honor. And to all the listeners out there, thank you very much for your time too.
That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It means a lot to me that you do. Would you be willing to share Getting Work to Work with your friends, other creative professionals, and entrepreneurs? You can send them to gwtw.co or have them search for Getting Work to Work on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work, or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice, encouragement, or just want someone to say hi to, drop me a line by sending me an email. I'm chris@chrismartinstudios.com, or you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm @CMStudios. Are you looking to increase your creativity and curiosity? Then sign up for the Curiosity Lab. Each week, you'll get inspiration, connection to new ideas, and updates on Curiosity Builders, an online community I'm creating for creative professionals and entrepreneurs to learn, engage, and grow. You can sign up today at thecuriositylab.net or at the bottom of the show notes page at gwtw.co/221. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.